Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Does racism persist today because of the bigotry of individuals or organized hate groups, or because of racist policies embedded in the fabric of American society? What role have local, state, and federal governments played in promoting segregation and protecting white privilege? Tonight, we'll explore the topic of structural or institutional racism, basically how government, housing, tax, and transportation policies have promoted segregated neighborhoods, schools, and communities, and in turn, restricted equal access to education and employment opportunities. And of course, we'll try to hope for some remedies to this longstanding set of discriminatory practices as the hour unfolds. Joining us here in the studio tonight to explore these issues and more is Robert Smith, professor of political science at San Francisco State University and author and co-author of scores of articles, essays, and 10 books. Most recently, American Politics and the African American Quest for Universal Freedom. He has taught African American politics and American government for more than 35 years. Welcome back to the program, Professor Smith.
Thank you.
We're also hoping to be joined a little bit later in the hour by Dr. Amos Brown. Dr. Brown has been the pastor of San Francisco's Third Baptist Church since 1976. He is also a scholar, theologian, and longtime social activist. He's a former San Francisco supervisor and the current president of the San Francisco chapter of the NAACP. And joining us by phone, we have Richard Rothstein. He's author of the new book, The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. Richard Rothstein is a research associate of the Economic Policy Institute and a fellow at the Thurgood Marshall Institute of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, as well as a fellow of the Haas Institute at UC Berkeley. Welcome, Richard Rothstein.
Thank you.
And of course, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes. I'll give you that phone number now. It's 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us now at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment at the KLW website or tweet us, cityvisionsKALW. So, Robert Smith from San Francisco State University, I wanted to start with you. We have less than an hour at this point to talk about the very troubling history of our country, especially when it comes to racism and specifically institutional and structural racism having extended, you know, for centuries in this country. For tonight, I wanted to start off by understanding what you and others in your field understand to be institutional or structural racism, and how is it different from what we think of when we think of racism, which is more sort of on a one-on-one level or a smaller group level?
Yes, this distinction between individual and institutional racism was initially given to us by Stokely Carmichael and Charles Hamilton in their 1967 book, Black Power. They talked about two types of... First, let me say how they defined racism. They said racism was to take race into consideration for purposes of subordinating a racial group, for doing something negative to a racial group. And they said that racism took two forms, individual, in which an individual person took race into consideration to deny a person a job or housing or whatever. And then they said institutional racism was when the normal patterns and practices of American institutions had the same outcome as if individuals took race into consideration. But they suggested it was not necessarily that. It was the way institutions normally operated, standard operating procedures that could have the effect of racism, that is, the same effect as if someone took race into consideration on an individual basis. Individual racism since the 1960s civil rights legislation is illegal. That is, it is illegal for you or any other person in any position to take race into consideration, to deny a person anything. Nevertheless, we know that blacks are routinely denied jobs, housing, certain kinds of medical procedures. They pay more for commercial transactions. So racism is still there. It takes an institutional form. And this is a tricky question. How can you separate institutions from individuals? Because institutions don't exist apart from individuals. So we know that's about where we are. In some cases, it's you can actually get a little bit of a handle on whether this is purely institutional, normal, routine operating procedures, in which an African-American performing his job would produce the same outcome. Sometimes you can see that. In other cases, it's blurry, whether this is individuals corrupting institutional practices and procedures, or whether it's simply individuals doing what they're supposed to do and therefore getting a racist outcome. Maybe we went a little bit too long. Sorry.
No, that's great, because actually you got to my follow-up question, which is, you know, our institutions are obviously made up of individuals, and yet you're describing something that's more than the sum of the individual parts.
Yes.
When it comes to institutional racism.
Yes. If you look at that mortgage loans, and we feel this disparity where you control for social class, you have just equally similarly situated people. And African Americans are much more likely to be offered a loan. And if they are, they're offered at differential rates. And so we see this pattern. And then you go in and ask the people who actually made the decisions, why did you do this? And, of course, they say they did not do it. So there must be something wrong. It may be a kind of subconscious bias going on in many of these areas, in health delivery and employment and in mortgage loans and rental and housing, where people engage in a kind of unknowingly subconscious bias that they really don't know that they're doing. It's there. We don't know that, but that's a possibility. When you confront people with the systematic evidence that this has been going on in your institution for some period of time, and they deny it, and then you say, no, you can't deny it because here's the evidence. They say, well, they just start blathering.
Yeah. So that's a really great pivot point to bring you in, Richard Rothstein, because this notion of conscious or unconscious racism, also known, you know, as implicit bias or explicit bias, mm-hmm. although I know bias and racism are not the same thing, but just to have those concepts in our mind, your book that just came out, The Color of Law, Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America, not only suggests, states clearly that this was not unconscious. This was in many ways deliberate. The policies that you'll tell us more about as the hour unfolds. Is that right?
Well, yes. I'm not in my book. I'm not concerned terribly much with individual prejudice or even with the effects of institutions. What I'm describing is that we have a myth, a national myth, that the reason that the country is segregated, that every metropolitan area is divided between predominantly black and predominantly white residential areas. The myth is that this is something that we call de facto. It just happened because of, as we were talking about, individual personal decisions or informal processes or maybe the implicit effects of the way institutions operate. And what I've shown is that this is a myth. In fact, we have what the courts called de jure segregation. The residential areas of every metropolitan area in this country have been segregated by very explicit, racially conscious, racially purposeful government action that was designed to segregate the races in our metropolitan areas and whose effects still persist today. The Supreme Court says that if you have explicit governmentally created segregation, it's unconstitutional, and it requires a remedy. Even the most conservative of Supreme Court justices say that. What they forget is that, in fact, it was created by government. They assume that it wasn't. But since the reality is that government purposely segregated metropolitan areas, we do require remedies. And government segregated it in two very important ways, but many, many others as well. One was the public housing program, which originally began in the 1930s for middle-class, lower-middle-class families who were without housing in the Depression. It wasn't for African-Americans. Creating some housing for African-Americans was an afterthought. It was mostly for whites. And the public housing program segregated metropolitan areas that had never known segregation before. In many cases, it demolished, integrated downtown neighborhoods in urban areas, and many urban areas have integrated neighborhoods because workers didn't have cars and they all had to live close enough to their factories to walk to work. And the federal government demolished those neighborhoods and built segregated public housing, sometimes public housing for whites only.
The so-called urban renewal.
Excuse me?
The so-called urban renewal.
Well, this is a public housing program. They demolished the neighborhoods, which were integrated in many cases, but this wasn't an urban renewal program designed to clear land and build hospitals and universities and private housing for middle-class whites. This was a public housing program, which was used to segregate metropolitan areas. And the second major program that the federal government used to create segregation was a program of the Federal Housing Administration. Many people are aware of the fact that the Federal Housing Administration redlined, that is, it didn't insure mortgages for African Americans in black neighborhoods. But that's a minor part of what the Federal Housing Administration did. Its primary role was to subsidize the suburbanization of the entire country, the white population of the entire country, on condition that those suburbs that it was subsidizing not sell any homes to African Americans. So, for example, the big development in Daly City, south of San Francisco, Westlake, was built with Federal Housing Administration guarantees on condition that the development sell no homes to African Americans. So gradually, the white population was moved out of urban areas in these giant suburbs. Daly City, Westlake is only one of many, many like that in every metropolitan area in the country. The white population was subsidized to move out of the central cities into these white-only suburbs, and increasingly the African-American population was concentrated in segregated public housing in central cities. So this was not the result of personal prejudice, and it wasn't even the result of informal institutions. It was an explicit program of the federal government to desegregate metropolitan areas. Its effects remain today. They remain with us today, and they've never been remedied.
So what's interesting in hearing your comments there is that this so-called white flight that we hear so much about was really not so much white people being pushed out by perceived risk of racial strife and harm to themselves, but really being pulled by the inducements to move out to the suburbs. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. I mentioned before that public housing was originally for white families. When white families were subsidized to move into suburbs, with FHA loans or with VA loans, the rents, the monthly carrying charges for those mortgages that the FHA and the VA gave them were less than the rents that they were paying in public housing. So this was not a question of people just fleeing on their own. This was a question of the federal government subsidizing and creating enormous incentives for the white population and only the white population to leave central cities. And as I say, this was not an implicit program. This was very explicit. The Federal Housing Administration's manual said that African Americans should not live in white neighborhoods. So we've forgotten this history, and that's why I call my book A Forgotten History. It was once well known. There's no secret about the fact that Daly City, on federal government requirement, could not sell homes to African Americans, and the same thing is true in every other neighborhood in the country and suburb in the country. And it was no secret that public housing projects were specifically designated either for African Americans or mostly for whites only.
And how do you think, staying with you just for one moment, Richard Rothstein, why do you think or how do you think that this history was forgotten? I can imagine there's lots of motivations for it, but these kinds of things, you don't easily get forgotten, I imagine. Why did they get forgotten?
Well, I think the main reason it got forgotten is because it's very difficult to deal with and people want to avoid having to confront the enormous intervention that will be required to undo this constitutional violation. You know, we desegregate buses. The next day, anybody can sit wherever they want on a bus. When we desegregate lunch counters, the next day they can sit anywhere they want in the restaurant. If we desegregate schools, if we enforce it, it's simply a question of people going to the school in their neighborhood. But if we try to desegregate housing that was specifically segregated by government, how do we do that? It's not as though the next day people can move to a suburb that was previously denied to them. So it's a very difficult thing to undo. It can be undone, but it's very difficult. And in order to avoid confronting the great difficulty of undoing it, I think people have forgotten how it happened.
Robert Smith, what's your take on Richard's thoughts so far?
Well, there's historical racism. One of the distinctions I draw in terms of this typology is historical racism, individual racism, institutional racism. And the case he makes in the book, I've not read it, but other studies have documented this. This was legalized racism, where it was not illegal to take race into consideration to deny blacks housing. That did not become illegal until 1968 with the Fair Housing Act. So the history he recounts, this forgotten history, may be forgotten, but it's very, very clear that the United States government, all governments, but particularly the federal government, deliberately set about to create ghettos. Even before the United States government got into the housing business itself, Chicago and Los Angeles and Detroit deliberately created ghettos. They did it through the force of law sometime. They did it, in some cases, through mob violence. The point here is, well, 2 points. One, since 1968, governments legally cannot do what they historically did to create this pattern. And second, Professor Rothstein talks about a remedy. The courts have been very, very reluctant, the Supreme Court, to fashion remedies to deal with the consequences of historical racism, because they know if they went down that road, the logic of it is some kind of reparations. That is, if you wish to undo what he describes in this book and repair the damage, you could do the same thing for people who were denied jobs right through until the 1960s. When I was growing up in rural Louisiana, I graduated from high school in 1965. I could not use the public library. I couldn't even go to the library to get a book, his book, for example. So I would say, if you want to get into this history of racism and begin to undo that damage, I sit here as a 70-year-old man and claim that I was damaged way back in the 1960s because I was denied access to an education, the library, that my counterparts easily had access to. So I would like to see what Professor Rothstein has talked about, what kind of remedy he thinks might be fashioned to address this, because I certainly would support it, but I doubt the courts would.
So before you get to answering that question, because I do want to have hear your answer about that, Robert Smith, can we do a quick economic analysis of what was the cost to African American populations across this country for being written out literally of housing, and then from there, you do an analysis in your book. Why don't you just walk us through that and give us a sense of not only what the cost is cumulatively, but what it means sort of down the road, the implications for communities, even though this is technically illegal today, in terms of people's ability to be mobile, socially mobile, economically mobile, if they're an African American.
Sure. I'm sorry. Sure, I can do that. Let me first say that, with all respect, housing discrimination was illegal since 1866, and it was unconstitutional when practiced by the federal government since the adoption of the Civil War amendments in 1866.
Why did the Congress find it necessary, under great controversy, to pass the Fair Housing Act largely as a consequence of the assassination of Martin Luther King?
That's right, but just 2 months after the Fair Housing Act was passed, the Supreme Court belatedly recognized that in 1866, housing discrimination had been abolished.
I don't think you should leave the listeners with the impression that blacks had a legal right, enforceable at law, to have access to housing prior to that very, very important Fair Housing Act of 1968, which explicitly made it illegal to do what they had been doing all those years that you described.
Well, as I say, I think I show in my book that it was illegal all along, and the federal government refused to enforce and failed to enforce the 1866 civil rights law, that made private housing discrimination.
Well, let's just...
Let him finish, and then you can respond.
Let me finish. And it was only in 1968, 2 months after the Fair Housing Act was passed, that the Supreme Court belatedly recognized that the 1866 law was valid. But let me go on to...
Let me get a word in there.
I did say Robert Smith could respond there. Let him respond.
Yeah,
and then we'll move off of this disagreement.
Yes, historical thing here. Black people, by your reasoning, had the legal right to vote from the 1860s, right?
Yes,
but it did. But it took the Voting Rights Act of 1965 before I could vote. So it may have been some vague statute way back, but I could not vote until 1965, in spite of having that right on paper for 100 years. So you're talking about an obscure statute that no one paid any attention to.
Or deliberately ignored,
yes,
it sounds like.
That's why Congress had to act.
Go ahead. I'll let you do one more response there, Richard Rothstein.
Well, should I go on to the other point or respond to this?
Go ahead and respond to this, and then
I'll stop.
And then we'll stop.
You know, the fact that something was illegal doesn't mean that that it was enforced, that the legal rights were enforced. In fact, the 1968 Act had very weak enforcement. It wasn't until 1988 that any meaningful enforcement rights were added to the 1968 law. The important point, I think, on this point, is that since the Civil War, the right of the legal and the constitutional right of African Americans to purchase property in any neighborhood that they wanted was not honored because the federal government both refused to enforce the 1866 law and because the federal government unconstitutionally prohibited African Americans from the rights guaranteed to them in the Constitution to purchase property anywhere they wanted.
So it sounds like there's constitutional rights, and then there's rules or regulations about sort of how those things either get interpreted or misinterpreted.
Well, let me give you an example. The 1954 Supreme Court's decision on segregation of schools. Nobody thinks that it was constitutional to segregate schools before 1954.
Oh.
Nobody thinks it was legal to segregate schools before 1954. What happened in 1954 is the Supreme Court belatedly recognized that it was unconstitutional, but it had been unconstitutional all along. The Supreme Court didn't make it unconstitutional in 1954. It only recognized that it was unconstitutional.
Well, we could have a whole discussion.
This is a very interesting flashpoint, not
right,
one I expected.
Because I think virtually everyone in the country until 1954 thought that segregated schools were indeed constitutional, basing that on the court's decision in Plessy.
No, everyone didn't. If everyone did, then there would have been no efforts to undo that.
No, the effort was
always. Excuse me. There were always opponents of that misguided decision. There was the decision. Plessy itself wasn't a majority decision. And throughout the 20th century, there were people who opposed it. The NAACP began a legal struggle to undo the Plessy decision with regard to schools in 1933. So it's not that everybody thought so, but the Supreme Court was misguided, and certainly many people supported that view. But I would like, if I could, to get to the other part of your question. May I do that?
Yes, and in order to do that, I first have to do a little station break here to reintroduce the program. In case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on 91.7, local public radio, KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're talking about America's history of institutional racism, how government policies have segregated neighborhoods, schools, and communities, and the resulting inequities affecting wealth and opportunity for people of color. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. How integrated was the neighborhood you grew up in? How about your school? Did you grow up with a sense of yourself as a member of a racial group? And if so, how did that shape your identity? Call us with your questions and comments. The number to dial to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, or tweet us, City Visions, KALW. So, yes, back to you, Richard Rothstein. Before we took this tangent. I had asked you to talk about the economic analysis of the impact on African Americans of these institutional policies, racist policies of the federal government.
Right. Well, in my book, I describe, for example, Levittown, which is another place like Daly City. It's another enormous suburb that's east of New York City. There's another one would be Lakewood in Los Angeles. These suburbs were financed by the Federal Housing Administration with guaranteed bank loans to builders on condition that no homes be sold to African Americans. At the time, those homes sold, I'm talking about the late 1940s and early 1950s, for about $10,000 a piece. In today's dollars, that's about $100,000, or twice national median income, roughly. Working class families of either race could have afforded to buy those homes. Twice the national median income, $100,000, is affordable to working class families today. But only white families were permitted to buy those homes. Well, today, homes in suburbs like that sell for $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 apiece, seven, eight times national median income. They're no longer affordable to working class families, black families. So telling black families that now they have a right to exercise their right to buy homes in those places is not really a meaningful reform. In the course of the last two to three generations, the white families who bought homes in those suburbs in the subdivisions that were financed by the federal government gained $300,000 to $400,000 in equity. The African American families who were prohibited from buying into those suburbs and were forced to rent apartments and overpriced apartments usually in urban areas gained none of that equity. The white families who were able to buy homes for, like I say, $100,000 in today's terms back in the 1940s, 50s, used that wealth that they accumulated over the next couple of generations to send their children to college, to take care of their elderly parents, to take care of medical emergencies. African American families gained none of those benefits. Today, the average African American income, family income, is about 60% of white family incomes. But average African American household wealth is about 5% of white household wealth. And that enormous difference between a 60% income ratio and a 5% wealth ratio is virtually entirely responsible, entirely the responsibility of federal government unconstitutional housing policy that was practiced in the mid-20th century.
So, Robert Smith, what do you think of that economic analysis of the gross disparity?
The major source of wealth for the average American is not the market or stocks or bonds. It's equity. And so the fact that African Americans were denied access to housing is partly, in fact, large part responsible for this more than wealth gap. So there's no question about that. And again, it was deliberate. I guess my quarrel with Professor Arasan is whether or not that deliberate racism was legal or not. That's a quibble we could have there, but certainly the case he makes here is unassailable. That the question I would ask, I gather he thinks the court should attempt to fashion a remedy for this. Is that his view?
You can ask him yourself.
Yes, is that your view, Professor?
No, what I think is that the American people have to become reacquainted with this history to understand that this was done in an unconstitutional fashion and adopt policies through Congress to remedy this. And if Congress did adopt such policies, I think the courts would have to uphold them, because if they would only adopt such policies at a time when there was a consensus in favor of this. And so the purpose of my book is to try to help educate Americans about the history so they'll understand the constitutional necessity of these kinds of remedies. I don't think it can be remedied by litigation. I don't think that the courts can fashion a remedy. I think it's up to the people to fashion a remedy, to Congress to fashion a remedy. But if Congress did fashion a remedy, then it would certainly be incumbent upon the court to uphold it, and I think it would.
And why do you draw that distinction? Why do you think congressional policy or lawmaking is going to be the answer here and not the courts or litigation, as you say?
Well, because the wrongs were committed 60, 70 years ago. Because the housing is so much more rooted in our structure than, for example, buses and restaurants, the effects still endure. But the wrongs happened 60, 70 years ago. You can't find individual plaintiffs who can demonstrate that some remedy applied to them is necessary. You can't, for example, if an African-American today said that the reason that he was not able to go to college was because his parents couldn't buy a home in Levittown or in Daly City, his grandparents couldn't, that would not be something he could prove in a court of law. Maybe there are other reasons he didn't go to college. So it's not something for individual litigation, but it is something that needs to be remedied.
And so are you talking about remedying moving forward and not retrospectively then?
Well, yeah, I think that that we need to fashion remedies moving forward. I don't know what a retrospective remedy would be. I mean, I can think of some very radical ones, but I think that there are a lot of things we need to do short of radical ones. I can describe a radical one to you. For example, you could say that let's take Daly City. The African-American population of that area is, 9, 10, 12%. If the federal government should buy up the next 12% of homes that come for sale in Daly City at market rates at $500,000 and resell them to qualified African-Americans for $100,000. But that's not a remedy that anybody is seriously going to entertain until we've done a lot of more modest remedies, which are certainly available on the way to something so radical.
So Robert Smith, I'll let you comment there.
Several years ago, maybe perhaps a decade ago, Douglas Blackman published a book called Slavery by Another Name, which also was a forgotten history of how African Americans were essentially re-enslaved, bartered and sold and brutalized. It's just slavery with another name. This is right up
cropping, for example.
Yeah, up to the 1950s, some papers of the 1960s. A PBS documentary was made about that. And the public is, I hope, aware of it. At least the informed public is aware of it. But there's been no effort to remedy. The only remedy for this, you can take a case of denial of access to housing, jobs, libraries, education at LSU, or Mississippi State, all these years. The only remedy for that is reparations, comprehensive reparations, to address not the discrete housing or the discrete employment or the discrete, but to address the, 3.5 centuries of degrading black people, not just denying them houses in Daly City, but denying them their basic humanity. So that's the real remedy.
So what do you think of Richard Rothstein's distinction of what the strategy is here, literally?
I don't take anything out of it. It's not going to work in the courts for sure. I don't think the courts have said they're not going to remedy historical racism because it would require, in effect, reparations. I don't think the American public is sensitive to these issues. If they're not sensitive to slavery by another name, which is not only a best-selling book, but a PBS documentary, I don't think they're going to be particularly aroused by the fact that there was widespread discrimination in housing in the United States for all these many years. By the way, it continues. There's ample documentation that in certain areas of the country, right here in the Bay Area, for example, that if I sent my black son to get a house that was advertised in certain parts of this area, he would not get it because he's black. So this is not just a past, it's ongoing racism in the United States, in housing, in employment, et cetera.
Is this institutional or individual, or both?
We know it's institutional. We don't know the role that individuals play, but we have documented data. If you just send people out to test for housing or jobs, you find this kind of widespread discrimination. And the persons are confronted with it, they say, well, I didn't do it. So it's a complicated thing that's difficult
to prove,
to sort out. in a scientific way, social science way.
Hard to prove, isn't
yes,
it?
Yeah. Yes.
So back to this issue. So if the court, we can't do it through the courts, right? You agree with that as
yes.
well. Richard Rothstein suggested it would be Congress that could help.
Yes.
And you seem to push that aside.
Well, the Congress we have now, of course, is hardly sympathetic to these kinds of things. But I cannot envision a Congress being elected that would be sympathetic. What we need is a mass movement for reparations. We need the civil rights movement brought about the criminalization of racism in the United States. That's what brought that about, a mass movement, multiracial, multicultural. We need a mass movement for reparations to remedy not housing discrimination, but remedy legalized slavery, slavery by another name, and the ongoing racism in the United States.
And say more. What would that look like? What would it be trying to achieve, and over what time frame?
The reparations would try to close the wealth gap. To close the wealth gap. Because you can close the income gap. You can make progress in closing the education gap. But you have to control the wealth gap if black people are going to be in an equal standing in a society that is as thoroughly capitalist as this. If you don't have access to wealth, you're not going to have access to power. Access to wealth, access to power, access to housing, access to all the things that flow from that. I wish African-American leaders who are very timid and very, very unwilling to address this issue. People have been pressing it for many, many years. They're too timid to address it. They won't want to talk about it. But nothing else is going to address these systemic problems except that.
So say if you do have some concrete ideas of what exactly would it take to decrease the wealth gap?
Oh, no, it would require this transfer to an African-American-controlled institution or a series of institutions over time of trillions of dollars in money to pay the debt. And that money then would be used to develop the African-American community in both the rural South and in the ghettos of the North. We're talking about, in a sense, a Marshall Plan, an internal Marshall Plan with funds set aside, democratically accountable, to begin to undo the damage that you can see if you go to any inner-city community in the United States or you go to any parts of the rural South. In fact, the rural South is much worse. The degradation, the poverty, the sense of hopelessness, the lack of opportunity, schools. Whites have abandoned the schools in the South, for example. They essentially resegregated all black schools with no money because the whites have abandoned them, went to private schools, and left them with just a pittance of resources to educate kids.
I'm going to reintroduce the program. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're joined by Richard Rothstein. He's author of the new book, The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. And we're also joined by Professor Robert Smith, Professor of Political Science at San Francisco State University. We invite you to join our conversation by dialing 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, or tweet us, cityvisions@KALW. So, Richard Rothstein, what do you think of this notion of a fund or funds that would be where monies and the trillions of dollars would be paid into to then the so-called Marshall Plan that Robert Smith espouses? Is that something that you had in mind when you were thinking of congressional policies here?
Well, that's a possibility. There's a wide range of policies that we could implement to undo the unconstitutional segregation that we've created. I think most people, when they think of reparations, and I'm not opposed to the term, but when they think of reparations, they think of individual payments, direct payments to African Americans. And the kind of Marshall Plan that Professor Smith is talking about is not that, and it would engage in a lot of activities besides simply transferring money to individuals. But there are many policies that we could pursue. For example, one of the biggest housing program that we have in this country today is the mortgage interest deduction, which goes to suburban, to any homeowner, single-family homeowner, who can deduct his mortgage interest from his home. It's a subsidy mostly to white middle-class families. One reform that we can implement, for example, would be to withhold the mortgage interest deduction from homes that are located in segregated suburbs, suburbs that have been segregated by government action, require those suburbs, for example, to permit the construction of modest homes. Many suburbs have exclusionary zoning ordinances that require that homes be built on multi-acre sites or have enormous lot sizes and a large number of bedrooms. And they're designed sometimes and frequently to prevent not only low-income families from or middle-income families from building homes in those communities, but particularly African-Americans. So if a suburb has an ordinance like that and does not take steps to integrate, the mortgage interest deduction could be withheld from homes in that suburb. That's one kind of reform that could be implemented that would be successful in permitting African Americans to move into suburbs that were previously from which they were previously excluded. So there are many, many, and perhaps that's the kind of program that the Professor Smith has in mind when he talks about a Marshall Plan. So I support those kinds of things. I think they would be necessary, but I don't think they're going to happen. And I want to emphasize this again: I don't think they're going to happen until we do a much better job of educating the American public about how segregation happened.
Okay, as long as
people believe that this all happened by accident, it happened because of private prejudice or because of individual choices or because people like to live with one another, there's not going to be the motivation or the ability to mobilize people around the reform. If people understand that it was done by government in an unconstitutional fashion, there's then a possibility of building support to remedy it.
So Richard Rothstein, I want to ask a controversial question because I think it begs the question: what's in this for white people? Why would they put their support behind something? I mean, they could maybe abstractly think of sort of the moral justification for something like this, but when it comes down to their dollars and cents and how their daily lives could be impacted, how do you push through what might be like, well, but now it comes down to actually me paying for this in some way. How would you push through that? Do you think the horror, so to speak, of the policies and for how long they've gone on would be enough to motivate and sustain that kind of support?
Well, I have several answers to that. First of all, we have a constitution which is written to protect the rights of minorities. So every policy we implement doesn't have to benefit the majority. And so long as we have a constitutional democracy, we have to forge ahead with enough political support, obviously, because we can't do it otherwise, to implement policies that do benefit minorities. But beyond that, segregation harms whites as well as blacks. Sometimes I'm asked about education. Does a black child have to sit next to a white child to learn? And I say, yes, a black child has to sit next to a white child to learn, and a white child has to sit next to a black child to learn. Many studies in social psychology have found that decision-making is impeded when people are not in diverse groups, when people are in homogenous groups and same race groups or same income groups, they tend not to challenge each other's assumptions. So we lose productivity in the country because of segregation. We certainly understand that we're at constant risk of massive violence in our cities because of the existence of segregated neighborhoods. If we didn't have segregated neighborhoods, police would not be an occupying force in those neighborhoods, and young African-American men would not be without hope because they're living in places without jobs or without access to jobs. So certainly that kind of social instability is a threat to the white population as well as to the African-American population, just as we talked about before. We enacted civil rights laws in the 1960s because of massive rioting that resulted from primarily practices of police in killing and otherwise harming African-American men in segregated neighborhoods. So we cannot continue, I don't think, successfully as a democracy or as a peaceful democracy unless we address segregation. I don't know when the next, and none of us knows, when the next Ferguson or Baltimore or Milwaukee or Charlotte will take place, but this is not something that white Americans can be immune from. So I do think segregation harms whites as well as African Americans, but there is no doubt that remedying it will benefit African Americans more, but that's what we have a constitution for.
Robert Smith, do you want to respond
there?
Well,
the Constitution was not designed to protect minorities. The Constitution, except minorities of wealth and property, the Constitution was designed to oppress and subordinate the principal minority group in the country, African Americans. So that's just, again, a kind of historical quibble, I guess, we could have. But no, I think in order to get a remedy to this, which, again, I say is reparations, can only come about as a result of a mass, hopefully multiracial movement to get Americans to not just recognize the injustice of housing discrimination, but the dehumanization of black people in this country under the Constitution for all these many years. That is what I think is the remedy, the ultimate remedy.
So the question there is, it could be on moral grounds, right?
Yes.
But when it comes to economic impact on the people who have been advantageous, have had the advantage and the privilege all this time, how do you push it through?
You have to be power. You have to create a situation. You have to create a crisis. You have to make people understand that if you do not remedy this problem comprehensively, there'll be no peace. There'll be disruption. There'll be protests. There'll be violence. This has to be, and again, I place the responsibility for this not on white America now. I place the responsibility for this on black leadership for their unwillingness to tackle this issue in a forthright way and put it on the agenda of America. Reparations to close the wealth gap and empower the African American community.
So I want to welcome Dr. Amos Brown. Thanks so much for persevering to get here to the studio this evening. I'm really glad that you were able to make it. Just to remind our listeners, Dr. Amos Brown is the president of the San Francisco chapter of the NAACP, and he's a minister of the Third Baptist Church here in San Francisco, and also an activist.
And a legendary figure in the civil rights movement.
And a legendary figure in the civil rights movement. I don't know how much of our hour you've been able to hear on your car ride over here.
I was not able to hear it. I was in another meeting.
Okay. No worries. No worries. So so what we've been talking about tonight is basically making the case about how institutional policies over decades and centuries have led to the not only income inequalities but the wealth gap between African Americans and whites in this country. And so we're at the point of talking about reparations and what form that would take. So that's where we bring you in. You also were a former member of the Board of Supervisors here in San Francisco.
Yes.
So we haven't yet talked about San Francisco. We have a storied history in this area, especially with the Fillmore and other urban renewal, so to speak, projects that went terribly wrong. Tell us about your perspective on how San Francisco fits in this argument and what potential reparations could we lead by example with?
San Francisco simply, in my estimation, just mirrors the evil of that birth defect, as Condoleezza Rice said, of America. It's race, something we don't like to talk about. And because of white privilege, institutionalizing the dehumanization, the withholding of goods, not respecting the worth and dignity of black people. We were two-thirds human in this Constitution. And we have sown this wind, and we are reaping now the whirlwind. For example, in the city and county of San Francisco as we speak, it's sinful, it's shameful, it's ungodly, it's un-American that the median income for blacks per capita is $29,000. But for white folks, it's $101,000. And yet, it's not politically correct to do anything to stop this insanity. We made concessions for other people who were marginalized. Why can't we do the same thing for black folks? Black people built this country as slaves for nearly 300 years. Slaves. And I just can't get an understanding of where are white folks coming from when they will wink and look the other way in the face of the murder of Emmett Till in my native state of Mississippi. And just a few days ago, the widow of those two white men who killed Emmett Till, he was 14 years old, the same age I was. And yet the wife said, I lied. I didn't tell the truth. That kid didn't deserve what he received. But did Donald Trump say anything about that? And yet he can have a whole lot to say about terrorists and generalize on all Muslims. And he really played racial politics in his election. And nobody's gotten excited about it. We owe it to black folks for those years of slavery. We deserve reparation. We did it for the Japanese. We did it for the Jewish community, as we should have. But again, it is suggested that because you're black, you get back.
So what would those reparations look like for you?
I think it should be a program that is well honed and thought out. There's an economic empowerment. Businesses, I'm not talking about just a job. We had a job during slavery, but I'm talking about owning capital, being in charge of some of this earth's resources and goods. I think we should give tuitions free for blacks and others too. But we deserve it. And to show you how we're still impacted by racism, this young lady, Betsy.
Oh, the education secretary? Yes.
Betsy DeVos.
Yes, Betsy DeVos. Came up with the idiocy and the ignorance that historically black colleges and blacks should understand the premise of school choice, charter schools. Black people had no choice. During the days of slavery, even our ancestors, I'm sure Brother Smith can appreciate that. There's a book by a sister up at Harvard about black self-determination and self-education, in which there's a chapter that she documents. During slavery, they had what you call, and even Reconstruction, pit schools. They literally dug pits in the ground and put boards and thatch over the top to conceal their gathering place. To learn how to read and to write. Even fingers were chopped off. Ears were cut off if a black person was caught reading. Now, this nation, through religion, through law, and through custom, maintained this evil system. The axis of evil is not over there in the Middle East. Yes, there's some evil there, but we need to stop this nonsense that the axis of evil is only over there. And the right-wing Republicans have promulgated this untruth for too long.
So thinking of your history here in San Francisco, do you think that San Francisco is ready for the kinds of reparations that you're talking about? Do you think we could create some of those examples here?
If we don't get ready and show the will to do it, we will show again how hypocritical we are. San Francisco has been living a lie, and it's time that it admit it and stop throwing peanuts and crumbs at black people. Right now, in that Fillmore area, where during World War II, they needed us. Somebody wrote a little piece on who needs the Negro anymore. During World War II, blacks were needed to do cheap labor to unload the ships as longshoremen, to build the ships in the shipyards, and to provide personnel for the railroads. As white soldiers were sent off to war, they didn't trust us to be on the front line, for they were afraid that we would defect to the enemy because of the evils of racism in America. And that's also how this Tuskegee Airmen Enterprise came into being. That's how the movie Red Tails came about, because they said even black folks, Brother Smith knows this, couldn't fly airplanes. But Eleanor Roosevelt and Mary McLeod Bethune proved that we could, and they established that program at Tuskegee, and blacks were able to fly those planes. But my point I'm getting to, they needed us doing World War II, but after that war was over, up pops in 1948 the Redevelopment Agency. It was not about redevelopment, it was about black removal, getting us out of this town. And therefore, that last vestige of a presence in the Fillmore needs to be given to black development, and not apologize and not come up with this sense nonsense that we're going to make sure that people of color are able to compete. This belongs to black people who've been dislocated, pushed out of the city, so that we can have a watering hole. Everyone else has a watering hole.
So we have about a minute and a half left. I wanted to ask this question to both you, Robert Smith, and Amos Brown. The NAACP decided recently not to renew the contract of their current president, Cornell Brooks, citing that they want to rebrand a new strategy, rebrand their strategy for how to address the inequities and the discrimination of African Americans in the United States. What is that strategy going to look like?
Well, I don't think it's a matter of rebranding. It's just a matter of being more, aggressive. Because we've always had the same image historically in this country, fighting economic injustice, fighting political denial, engagement in the political process. The same old thing is going on. We just will be having a more engaged and militant movement. And we definitely got to do that during these present circumstances of politics in America. And I feel that we will find the right person to lead the organization. We've always arisen to the occasion.
Robert Smith, final word from you?
I'll defer to the good Reverend Brown here and endorse this idea of a militant spirit in the NAACP. And, you know, I always, every time the new head of the NAACP is selected, I always say I wish the NAACP could find a woman to do that job.
And let's pause there. That's City Visions for this evening. My guests were Robert Smith, professor of political science at San Francisco State University, Richard Rothstein, author of The Color of Law, Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America, and Dr. Amos Brown, pastor of San Francisco's Third Baptist Church and president of the San Francisco chapter of the NAACP. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Ann Harper. We'll be off next Monday for Memorial Day. Join me next time when we have a conversation with Deborah Tannen about her new book, You're the Only One I Can Tell, Inside the Language of Women's Friendships. This is Joseph Pache for all of us here. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.